If you really want to be anxious about something,
it's all relative.
So, so tonight we're going to have Martian Progressive Bioethics Commissions. Take it away. We're really going to try to be concise tonight, of course, so you can have a lot of time for the fun part.
So does the exam, just so that we're clear on the things, yeah. Once the presentation's over, the exam's going till 6:30?
Are you waiting for president
of the
class?
You take a wash. Can we have a wash break?
I nominate Kelly for class president.
No.
All in favor? Yes, we'll get to the break. Yeah.
I think we came to work. Because it was 5 hours. I don't know still it is. Is it 5 hours?
Yeah. Bell set?
No.
Okay. It's a long time.
This is what we are going to talk about. The accomplishment of the Presidential Commission. How was the National Bioethics? The NBAC position, the embryonic stem cells research position, the policy as progressive for the National Bioethics. Okay. Some examples. So this is the outline, so you know where the. Now, the risk or the what we are going to look is look at the how the VAC weights on the NIH director, the Federal Drug Administration, other the Department of Health Social Service. The questions that we are going to propose: what about the budgets? Humanitarian aid by the U.S., medicalization of torture, can they take on political, ethical areas, and how to plan sensibly from active scientific agenda. So those are the questions that we are going to propose, and you start thinking about it when we talk about here. So Erin Messling, here is his face, and I sent him an email, and he was so nice that he sent me a couple of slides that you are going to see. He said, please tell me what the students think about me. I said, of course I will like it. So this is, he was a representative commission, and he basically considered whether progressives should create a new model for bioethics commission that is better suited for creating real changes. So that's him. And this is obviously his background. But I found this very interesting. And, how can I get this? Yeah. No, the real clip of the video.
He was going to leave.
Yeah.
No, he has to
do it. Cool. Okay. It's going to come
so we are going to see a minute and a half, okay? So that's it. Oh, this sound.
It's a space too. University graduate. I taught at U of T and it's in my passport, which is still standing. Okay. It'll always be Canadian. I can show that to you. At any time.
Oh, yeah. Can we put a hold on it? Can you pause it? A little more background and a little O Canada.
Yes.
So Eric was the director or executive director of the Clinton Commission on Bioethics, now at the Indiana University Center for Bioethics. The funny thing about him, the Canada thing is that Harold Shapiro, who was then the president of Princeton, was the chair of the Clinton Commission. He grew up in Montreal. His brother, twin brother, was at the same time the president of McGill. And then, of course, Eric, who's from Ottawa, was the executive director of the commission. Nobody ever picked up on the Canadianization of American bioethics. It's a story that remains to be told, but it's very cute. Anyway, I guess here he's talking a little bit about the commission. Is that right?
Can,
so anyway.
Can you put it in?
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's watch.
And it's just this morning, one
she, alluded to this. She alluded to this comment, which I can't really resist responding to, something about going to Los Angeles and to the consul's office there, who heard about three types of Canadian hockey players, and there were two others. Turns out that there's another type of Canadian that occasionally leaves Canada, and I am the evidence of that, which is back in the day, a long time ago, this field called bioethics was just emerging, and there were no programs in Canada. So I left with the intention of coming back, which I did for several years at Sunnybrook and U of T, and then I got a couple of offers that I couldn't refuse. One of those offers was to work at the NIH on the Human Genome Project for 2 years with Francis Collins, the new NIH director. And then it was after my time at the NIH that I had the somewhat unreal experience of working for Bill Clinton for 4 years running his National Bioethics Commission. I mentioned that not to present my bona fides to you, but because it might help you understand a bit more about my presentation this afternoon. It's always difficult to be the lunchtime speaker. You're sort of metabolizing as you're listening. Raise my voice.
So this was a meeting back in Canada.
Yes.
Can you give us the context where he was speaking?
Yes. We have sort of the context in the slides. So, did you want to have the muscle?
Sure. So the NDAC was established in 1995 by Clinton. And really it was to provide advice and make recommendations to governmental and national science and other governmental organizations really on the appropriateness of policies, guidelines, regulations relative to bioethical issues from human research or human biology and behavior, and also talk about applications of that research. So what's specific about this is they're supposed to identify broad principles to govern decisions about ethical conduct of clinical research. They're not supposed to weigh on any specific or review any specific projects, but really a broad set of frameworks and guidelines and ways to think about these kinds of issues, the principles underlying them. Now, their charter, they had two first priorities, as always, you know, just one first priority, but the two first priorities were to protect the rights and welfare of human research subjects and also to look at issues in the management and use of genetic information. And that's really what this chapter is about, some of the outcome of that. Now, the motivation for the chapter is that Meslin was with Derflinger, who's from the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. They sat in a car, he was dreading this ride, where they were going, I don't remember where they're going specifically, and Derflinger turned to him and said, well, I don't agree with anything that you said, but I do agree with your consistent approach with respect to stem cell research. So, I guess this is a plus and a minus, He said he didn't like it, but at least he understood where they're coming from, and he was happy that they were consistent in the way they addressed this. Now, a little bit more about Richard Derflinger. He, in fact, was the man who almost killed health reform. And you can meet him if you actually read this article here. Mm-hmm. Now, you might want to say, so what were the recommendations, right? So the recommendations really were that the commission essentially believed that federal funding for the use and derivation of embryonic stem cell, embryonic stem, and embryonic germ cells should be limited to two sources, and that's either material from cadaveric fetal tissue and embryos remaining after infertility treatment. So that essentially was, they said, they looked through all the possibilities. These were the only two that they recommended. But it didn't win the day. Their position actually didn't win the day. Before this, the NIH had proposed had come up with a different proposition, which was essentially say you could work on embryonic stem cells, but they weren't going to fund the creation of embryonic stem cells. So while they thought they had a a pretty good pragmatic recommendation. It honored, you weren't creating stem embryos for the perspective, for the purposes of research. You weren't really changing the outcome of what would have happened to those particular embryos that were being used for stem cell research, but it didn't carry the day. Clearly, it was, while it was a sound recommendation, it didn't win over Bill Clinton. And so, although they didn't start this with a perspective that was, they didn't have the answer in mind when they started the question, they really took a scientific and analytical approach to really understanding stem cells. They didn't start with any sort of presumption around the sanctity of life or human dignity or moral status. They came up with a recommendation, but it was not, it just wasn't brought up, and they won't be an NIH recommendation. So that's kind of what happened to that. And again, so you could understand where Sherfling was coming from. He said, I don't agree with it, but I can at least see how you got there and how you were consistent in your approach to coming up with this answer.
Okay, so moving a little forward, I found this little video that is going to be, it's going to be 3 minutes. But it's good because at least you're going to see how a stem cell looks like under the microscope.
Is this me or a stem cell?
Okay.
Who is?
We all look at you
so you can tell the difference. God.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
Day for people and for the future of American science. Today, President Obama will rescind the limits on embryonic stem cell research that were created by President Bush in 2001. Now, these limits have meant that federal funds on embryonic stem cell research even though scientists say that they need hundreds, if not thousands, of more lines to make the kinds of advances that we need to address basic diseases from which millions of Americans suffer. The crucial change in the rules will allow NIH funding to be applied to many more
this
lines.
This is the filter that you used to select the stem cells.
So that the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, can do the job that it's really the best at doing in the country, which is coordinating work among many different laboratories, among many different universities, so that work is not redundant, and also helping the states coordinate their work so that the states can begin to benefit from the economic opportunities, as well as benefiting medical science, which is part of the mission of the state university system. In addition, President Obama will release a memo today that instructs the federal government to ensure that only the best evidence-based science is used as the foundation of government policy. And that in itself will be a big change from the last 8 years, when people have been coming out of the federal government, like a former Surgeon General, and saying that under President Bush, he was unable to say things that he felt he really needed to say to benefit the public health. In 2001, President Bush imposed pretty strict limits on human embryonic stem cell research in terms of the funding that the federal government could give for this very promising line of work. Human embryonic stem cells have the ability to form any cell in the human body.
This
in
is
principle, that means that if
boxes.
You got the cells to work in a certain way, they could replace disease tissue or aid disease tissue in any system in the human body that was malfunctioning, like a pancreas or a heart or a liver or a spinal cord. That's one possibility for embryonic stem cells. Another is that we could find more efficient ways and safer ways to develop new drugs using cells in the laboratory instead of putting experimental drugs in people. And yet a third, and maybe the most important, is to understand the basic genetics of disease at the very beginnings of human life so that we can get some clues as to how to address serious diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's that might only affect us in our sixth, seventh, or eighth decade of life, but which already are beginning to form very early on in our cells. So what we will see in the future, I think, is many more human embryonic stem cell lines that will be available for this kind of research, for drug development, for basic science, and in some cases even putting these cells into human participants in research. this is part of what scientists call regenerative medicine, the idea of using our cells to heal ourselves instead of drugs and surgery, or in many cases just waiting for
that's how you manipulate cells under the microscope.
This is a new way of doing medicine. This will be 21st century medicine. And it means that we're now in a position to build not only the medicine of the future, but the biotechnology of the future. Half of America's economic growth since World War II has been based on science and technology. The rest of the world has been moving forward, Southeast Asia, the United Kingdom, Europe, in many cases. We need to be part of this. We need to ensure that we continue the world leader in biotechnology. And the future of human embryonic stem cell research is a critical part of that.
Well, that's a dirty trick.
Okay, so when Mr. Obama became president, these are some of the decisions. And this slice is a courtesy of Dr. Schmeisling. Because we saw we read in one of the articles about the Mexico City Policy Resentment,
was the Mexico City?
Yeah, it's coming.
Oh, your kid's coming up?
Yeah. The Scientific Integrity Memorandum, the Federal Drug Administration, Department of Health and Human Service, appointments, and all that stuff that is related with the commissions. So the policy advice, as progressive, history or relying on expert study, and the issues of social and political importance in this millennium. So they consider the Great Library of Alexandria. Do you remember what it was? The Great.
Yes, it was an artistic. This is just a list of public consortiums, of groups of people who came together to provide recommendations, advice, some on science, not always, but there were independent groups of people outside of government and outside of
this
government.
Is starting in 100 AD.
Yes.
Right.
Those barber surgeons.
We look to experts to help provide advice for millennia.
Yes.
And
the campaign de Gaius Caviola. It was very interesting because that started with seven men in France who decided we had to get together and talk about science, arts, and interesting things.
When was that, Celia?
I'm sorry?
Do you know when that was?
Yeah, we have it.
Just about.
17th century. Yeah. These are enlightened institutions.
I have it on my guess.
Yeah. Okay, just generally.
We went to, as we say, somebody asked, we better be there.
Yeah. Somebody is definitely going to ask about the Campania, Doug.
Yes. So they think that the relationship between science and government was extended, and mid 20th century, the commission had replaced politicians and advisors with civilians with diverse academic backgrounds. And by 2005, they were bioethics commissions in at least 85 countries. So this is not just in the United States that there is this preoccupation; it's all over, everywhere. And Dr. Meslin is one of the ones who is interested. The policy advisors progressive, so the strength of government commissions depends on the members who are there. So the mission is the National Commission provide a source or a way to handle the issues that needs consensus building and elaborating in different views where there are conflicts. And they are concerned about the policymakers, and in this forest they consider this is how they crystallize consensus of politics or disagreement. They diffuse controversy issues in the decision making. They promote interdisciplinary research, identify emerging issues, formulate policies. Implementations and of laws that exist already, and propose regulations on guidance. So that's one. So this is the U.S. Congress Group published that, and all bioethics commission had done this to some extent, but controversies remain unresolved. Commissions had impact not only in policy guidelines, but also as an instrument of policy.
So, of course, part of, go to the next slide, there are some inherent limitations on bioethics commissions. They're commissioned by the President of Congress, so their longevity is tied to whoever's in power at the time. They're political by design, so this just feeds into the biopolitical nature of these bioethical committees. And they're advisory, they're not empowered to act. They can provide guidance, but they can't insist that anybody do something. They can't formulate laws. And so, in fact, if you look at this, here's a whole set of examples of where commissions have been put in place, but they've either been not funded, therefore they weren't able to do any work. There was one that Congress put in place in 1985, but they only met once in 4 years because they couldn't agree about their stance on abortion, so essentially they didn't meet. In 1988, they convened a human fetal tissue transplantation panel, but again, Reagan issued executive orders essentially prohibiting this type of research, so there was no point to actually issuing guidelines around it. We saw Clinton essentially disregard, I mean, he heard the recommendations, but he disregarded them, he didn't agree with them. But alternatively, the radiation experimentation panel was successful because there was a lot of status and they actually had authority as a presidential commission. So while in some cases the president or Congress can thwart these, they can also support them and actually give them power to do what they have to do, do the kind of work they need to be doing.
One of the reasons that the Radiation Experiments Commission was successful, seemed successful, and I think also the current commission's Guatemala report is because they were doing fact-finding. And so, you know, when you find facts, you find facts. When you make recommendations, they can be implemented or not. So, yeah.
So this is the one of the slides that the president sent, and this is the memorandum the administration when the restoration of Mexican policy, the city policy. So you can read what it's about, and I think in one of the papers that we have for the class also covers that. But I thought that this was a very good slide to show that it was official from the White House. Risks, benefits of progressive bioethics commissions. Commissions are not empowered to undertake political actions. So that's a risk. In general, bioethics commissions have been progressive. We say in general, because pragmatism prevails over ideology, and it's good. Individual rights and common goods are balanced against each other. They are transparent, as much as they can make it transparent. And scientific rigor and analysis is a value principle in developing solutions, so at least they have a good base. Continue with the risk. Some commissions have rejected right to consensus, so they say, no, we don't need consensus. This is what it is. We are going to do it this way. And it's clear that approach of the moral engagement was more effective than consensus approach. So it's between, are we going to reach consensus in these issues, or the moral issues prevail over decisions? So it's after the body of the commission.
So the President's Council on Bioethics took this deep moral engagement approach, and Eric is obviously advocating a more activist kind of evidence-based policy-oriented approach.
So, question for discussion, should commissions provide advice regarding skills, credential, mission, budget priorities for the National Institute of Health, the Federal Drug Administration, the Department of Health and Human Service? And this had huge impact on public goods, influencing the quality of life for the foundation. NIH influenced standards for human research, and the Federal Drug Administration, what are the priorities for them? And they focus on drug safety, And sometimes drug safety can be a barrier to innovation. And anybody who works for a pharmaceutical company has experienced that. and I think we both have dealt with that. Can they drive development of new antibiotics or other areas of medical needs?
So the real question is, can they do more than just advise? Can they actually provide some direction that will have a more active impact on?
And actually, I'm sorry we're not meeting for a couple of weeks, because I think within the next 2 weeks, the new Presidential Commission report will address some of these very questions. And we'll try to drive some of this discussion, but you'll just have to take it from me.
You'll have to pay attention.
Yeah, pay attention to the news. So it's, how many more slides you got?
Two more.
Again, so
this is okay. In some way, this was audacity, because all of these things we are going actually is more benevolence, social justice. But to me, audacity is what we need. And I was thinking that.
You sound like a president right now.
And that's right, the audacity. Because one of the things I was thinking that us as a class, would be great if we can go to a class, to one of these deliberations. I thought that I would be excited to be able to really feel it and think it and perhaps put a little...
You can. Just go to San Francisco the next meeting.
Well...
February 2nd and 3rd.
If we sell cookies, maybe we can make some money.
We've got to be big cookies.
So, this is the question. Do we have ethical obligations regarding global health? As is so, what are they? And how do we fulfill this obligation? What can science do? And this is one of Dr. Maslin's presentation. And the trends is the internationalization of science, technology, and research, from health philanthropy to venture philanthropy. And science politics is about more than science. So this is for you to think about it also, because that's what the global, the sphere is there, because we cannot be thinking about local only. And the last one.
Again, these are more questions. So could a bioethics commission take on a much broader question and answer these kinds of questions as opposed to, and clearly it's going to be what people commission them to do, but it's how do we think about these bioethics commissions? Should they be helping to develop solutions for access? You know, those are all areas where not only bioethics commissions, but bioethicists may want to play a more active role than seems to be playing now.
That's good.
Cool.
Thank you. Thanks. So, actually, this is a good lead-in to...
Oh, did we forget?
Is that your slide? Thank you. So, actually, this is a good lead-in to a discussion we won't be able to have about the next report, because you will see discussion about some of these global justice and bioethics issues in the next report, including some new ideas about the ethics of site selection when you're doing international research, a developing country doing research in a developed world country doing research in a developing world country, some of the issues about study design, placebo use. These things are going to be in the next report. So this is actually a good lead-in to that discussion that maybe we'll have informally after the holidays.
Maybe it's a colloquium. We could have a presentation from Amy or something like that. Like maybe
see what I can do. No, it's a good idea.
Is it in San Francisco?
The next meeting's in San Francisco in February, but I think Shelley wants to have it here or in Toronto.
Here, I'm here.
Oh, you're, okay, good. So we'll have it here if we at all can. Maybe we'll get Val Bonham, the chair, the executive director of the commission, has asked me about trying to schedule something up here in the spring, so we are working on that. Also, it's mentioned December 18th. Eric is going to be interviewing me on an NPR program that comes out of Indianapolis, which I'm sure will thrill you. Just a little other tidbit about Dorflinger, Richard Dorflinger, who is a very smart guy, who is, I think, the most effective spokesperson for the Bishops' Conference.
he actually had a really interesting idea during the Clinton years, during the National Bioethics Advisory Commission years. He started an American Bioethics Advisory Commission as a kind of a shadow commission under the sponsorship of the Bishops' Conference, which I thought was really pretty smart. Just to bring the stem cell subject up to date, just yesterday, a British group announced that they have developed the first clinically usable set of embryonic stem cell lines. Clinically usable in the sense that they were developed on using human culture, not a human culture medium, not an animal culture medium, so that it eliminates the possibility of developing viruses that could jump from the animal culture to the developing embryonic stem cells. So, at least in that respect, I haven't read any commentary on that yet, but at least in that respect, they're in principle clinically usable. I think there are a lot of other things that can happen to those cells in culture in the laboratory other than this, xeno problem. But anyway, that's what they're saying, that they could be clinically useful, and that is the future of embryonic stem cell research, I think, is to have stem cell banks from various sources, including human embryos. Okay, any comments, questions? You just get ready and eager, yeah.
I was just interested in the one in 1985.
Well, they never got it together.
They couldn't get together because they couldn't agree on a stance on abortion, but isn't that what's currently?
Well, so what happened with that commission was that they were, I think, the deal was there were supposed to be four people from each party, actually members of the U.S. Congress, four Republicans, four Democrats. And they could not agree on who should be members of the commission. That's a very unusual. The idea to have a commission made up of members of Congress, and that was an unusual and a non-starter, because they couldn't agree on who should be on it. Yeah, surprise, surprise. Tout ça change. In fact, one of the members of the commission died before they ever met officially. So they had a meeting of the staff. I think that was probably being alluded to. Robert Cook Deegan, who's a geneticist and ethicist at Duke. Now, was the executive director of the commission that never met. So it's like, I don't know, So was the Dutch, the ship of fools, or one of those mythological vessels that is always sailing somewhere but never gets to actually land anywhere. So that was that commission. It was kind of a sad story. Yeah. Okay. So we'll give you a couple of minute break to rejigger your brain. And we'll get started in like a couple of minutes.
Do you have any estimate as to how many words fit in one page?
No, as tiny as you can write, like Leonardo da Vinci.
My
can do mirror writing like Leonardo.
Handwriting is
beautiful. I'm sure.
At least my mother can write.
Mom is always.
I'm always thinking.
She thinks, yeah. Everything's perfect. Especially the boys. Girls, not so much.